For SDPB Radio, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment. If you're interested in South Dakota agriculture, boy, do we have a lineup for you. We hear from Kevin McNew, chief economist with the Farmers Business Network, about the impact of the new farm aid package. The CEO of Blue Dasher Farms talks regenerative ag. The senior advisor for South Dakota's Department of Agriculture joins us for a look at the 2019 Agriculture Economic Contribution Study. And, as always, the political junkies discuss this week's top political headlines. But first, U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson is in South Dakota for the August work period. Johnson is ranking member of the Agriculture Subcommittee on Nutrition and Oversight. And after recent hearings on SNAP benefit eligibility requirements, the USDA issued a rule to reform the process. Congressman Johnson discussed these changes with us. Let's take a listen. Well, let's start with what exactly is broad-based categorical eligibility, so folks understand what's
at stake.
Yeah,
I'll back up
here
even a half a step further, which is what is categorical eligibility, and that makes a lot of sense. That is for administrative efficiency, and that's what South Dakota uses, and that says, you know, if you qualify for a program that's for really poor people, like TANF, that's cash assistance for the poorest among us, clearly if you're that poor, you should also qualify for food stamps, which doesn't require you to be quite so poor, and that kind of administrative efficiency makes sense. That's the kind of thing that South Dakota uses, and that's the kind of thing that the administration federally wants to move toward having all states utilize. Broad-based categorical eligibility goes a step further, and I think it strains that concept a little too strong, and I'll give you just one example. There are some states where you can receive a brochure from the TANF program, and the state considers the receipt of that brochure as the receipt of, quote, a benefit, meaning you're eligible for food stamps, even though nobody ever checked your how many assets you've got. That,
how
I think, goes
brochure,
too far.
How is the brochure distributed? Just randomly at the park, or is there an application process to get the brochure?
No application process to get the brochure. I mean, that's why it is viewed as such an abuse. So what the Trump administration wants to do is say, hey, listen, to really be to get a TANF, quote, benefit, you have to receive $1,000 a year. And that, I think, makes sense. That means you're really on TANF rather than just receiving some de minimis benefit.
All right. So tell us about how this works with the administration and the USDA can make this policy change. Your committee is not making that policy change. Help us figure out who's exactly in charge of that decision.
Yeah. So we had a farm bill in 2018 in the last quarter of 2018 that came together. And there's actually a lot of welfare reform that happens in the farm bill, because 80% of the spending of any farm bill is on food stamps, SNAP. And there were debates, discussions about to what extent make this change in law. Ultimately, Congress was silent on this. So the congressional intent from previous farm bills was still in place. And I think when I look at it, congressional intent clearly supports categorical eligibility. I don't think it supports broad-based categorical eligibility.
So in South Dakota, we don't have the broad-based.
No, there should be no impact for South Dakotans with this change proposed by the administration. I mean, there may be, I'm sure somebody could put together a fact set where people would be impacted, but by and large, the people who qualify for food stamps and for TANF and for school lunches shouldn't be impacted.
What is the change then? What's changing?
Well, just that in these states that have really, really, you know, what it really comes down to for most people are, how many assets do you have? Right. There are there's a gentleman from Minnesota. He's called the Minnesota Millionaire. Mr. Undersander, and he has millions of dollars worth of assets. He volunteers his time in helping people, seniors by and large, sign up for welfare programs. And he realized that in Minnesota, they had taken this eligibility flexibility too far. And so he, by telling the entire truth and nothing but the truth on his application form, was able to receive food stamps. And he did this as a whistleblower. He wanted to bring attention to the fact that it is unfortunate that Minnesota lets people with $1 million of assets be on these welfare programs, which should be targeted toward the poorest among us. So what the Trump administration wants to do is just make it clear that for you to qualify for food stamps automatically because you're on TANF, for you to qualify for school lunch automatically because you're on TANF, you really do need to be on TANF.
Would that impact farmers or other people who maybe have assets that and yet are still very, very cash poor, and especially in the current climate with trade wars and the farm economy?
Yeah, I don't. In South Dakota, you won't see that kind of impact. I mean, there may be folks in Minnesota, for example, who, you know, have large operations and have millions of dollars of assets, and who can at times be cash poor. But I think as a country, we have to back up and we have to ask ourselves, in a world of very scarce resources, where we know that there are people out there who are really, really struggling, and who do we want our scarce food resources going to help? Is it the person with millions of dollars of assets, or is it the person who just doesn't have anything? And I think we want to start by focusing those resources on the most needy among us.
So during the subcommittee hearings, you were able to speak as ranking member, and you talked about bipartisanship in the sense that you said there's a lot of this that we agree on. And the chair, Congressman Fudge, talked about the bipartisan support for categorical eligibility from back to Bill Clinton and mm-hmm. Newt Gingrich making this partnership, and it's been a long standing. And then it didn't seem like there was a whole lot of bipartisan conversation other than those two statements that, you know, she made a statement and you made a statement, and the rest was a lot of, you know, you're attacking poor people, you're kicking kids off school lunches, this millionaire, it was a stunt that is now punishing millions of people and hundreds of thousands of school kids. Talk a little bit about that and sort of the notion of, you know, we have common ground, we want to get there, but yet this is an incredibly divisive issue about poor people being punished because a millionaire decided he wanted to prove a point.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most frustrating thing about Washington, you know, Washington, D.C. I mean, there are certainly some policy disagreements in this issue, but the real disagreements are political. And that is that everybody, I mean, my party's certainly not immune to it, but, you know, everybody is so interested in playing to the political rhetoric and trying to make the broader point about how Republicans are bad because we're coming up on an election, or Democrats are bad because we're coming up on an election, that it's hard to just get people to sit down and just cut the kind of common sense deal that needs to be cut. Here's what I know for sure. I know everybody on the Ag Committee believes that we need a social safety net. I know that everybody on that committee believes that that social safety net should be targeted toward people who need help the most. I know everybody believes that somebody who has millions of dollars of assets doesn't need help the most. So what are we fighting about?
And your answer is?
I think some people like, you know, I'm the top Republican on the committee, which is a real honor for a freshman. My approach, just because I come from South Dakota, I think is more often to try to find, I mean, if your worldview and my worldview only overlap 15%, well, that's where the magic happens. Let's go cut a deal on that 15%. I think, Chair Fudge, Marsha Fudge from Cleveland, who I have a lot of respect for, I think she is more of a typical member of Congress who I think is inclined to focus more on the differences of opinion and try to communicate message, not to the committee, but to the broader American public about where, you know, the opposition is wrong. And it's a different style. It's not one I'm in love with, I tell you that.
And so, I mentioned earlier in the conversation those headlines, which would be how many people are going to get kicked off of SNAP because of this. So I'm guessing Chair Fudge would say, that's what we're fighting about. We're fighting about those 3 million people.
Yeah, and the reality is, I mean, if you qualify, you know, again, South Dakota's, you know, we're not talking about South Dakotans here, but, you know, if we're talking about Minnesotans.
It's a nationwide conversation, yeah.
Right, and South Dakota does it in the way that the administration wants other states to do it. So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, kicking, you know, millions off of programs, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, thousands of South Dakotans for sure. You know, the reality is if you qualify for food stamp, I mean, if you qualify for reduced or free school lunch, if you qualify that for that program, you're going to be a part of that program. It's only because maybe you don't qualify for the program. You make too much money, or you have too much in assets. And so you have qualified kind of coming through the back door of another program that you are getting these free and reduced school lunches. So question number one would be, if you don't qualify for the program, why are we providing you that benefit? And does providing you that benefit come at the cost of somebody else who could use that benefit even more acutely? The second issue would be, the facts indicate, different studies say different things, but somewhere between 93 and 99% of the people who are on free or reduced school lunch today will continue to be on free and reduced school lunch in the future. So when people talk about millions being kicked off, there's actually no expert who thinks that that's going to happen. That's a political talking point, not real information.
So to be clear, when Chair Fudge sends a letter and says 3 million people are going to, and she quoted the Congressional Budget Office during the hearing and talked about 400,000 eligible households losing benefits, you're not saying that that many people are defrauding the system.
No, absolutely not.
Clarify that.
They
are.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the blame really rests with state governments. I mean, if they are saying that you can receive a de minimis benefit from one program, and that entitles you to thousands of dollars of benefits of food stamps, even though you don't qualify for that program, that's a problem. That is, we need to have a strong and efficient social safety net. That kind of flexibility, that kind of a loophole, actually weakens the safety net. And it doesn't target those resources. And so I don't, you know, listen, if somebody shows up and says, oh, hey, you received this de minimis benefit from TANF, so we're going to allow you access to food stamps, that person doesn't know they don't qualify. They don't know. I don't necessarily expect that they would go research that, oh, I can have two cars and I can have a house, but I can't have more than $2,500 worth of emergency fund. I have $3,200 worth of emergency fund. I shouldn't qualify. I don't expect them to do that research. What I expect is for a state government to follow the congressional intent that we should have flexibility in enrolling these programs, but that flexibility should allow eligible participants, not ineligible participants, to receive the benefits.
So does it just separate the application process? So you have to you have to apply for your free school lunch versus checking the box that says, I already am on SNAP benefits, therefore I get my free school lunch.
Well, so as long more, as you're, I mean, the proposed changes from, you know, the Department of Ag says that if you're getting more than $1,000 worth of benefit from TANF in a year, it is still streamlined. Okay. You would automatically qualify. If you received, you know, a de minimis benefit, then yeah, you'd have to fill out the, you know, 2-page application form.
South Dakota farmers affected by trade issues and adverse weather can now begin receiving payments as part of the Trump administration's $16 billion farm aid package. How are those figures determined? What's the process for receiving payments? And how are they being dispersed? Kevin McNew is chief economist with the Farmers Business Network, and he joined us to talk about the new farm aid package. So when we entered some of these the trade skirmishes that, you know, before we were really calling it trade war, and in some of the conversations, the administration said, we'll take care of our farmers. And a lot of farmers stood by the administration accordingly. Are they going to feel like this delivers on that promise?
You know, that's a really good question, Lori, and I'm sure one that the White House and policy pundits will want to poll on. I don't have a firm, you know, belief that farmers are firmly on one side of this coin or the other. I think everyone has their own perspective on the benefits of the trade war and what the final end game is. So I'm not sure that, you know, farmers as a group uniformly stack up on one side of that equation or another. I will say, you know, as an economist looking at this data and what I sort of perceive to be fair value for the market impacts, I think most farmers should be fairly satisfied with the payment rates. I can tell you, you know, wheat areas, you know, in the northern plains where, you know, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, where we're at, you know, last year they basically got nothing out of these trade war packages. And at least this year they're at least guaranteed $15 an acre. So it's not a big sum, but on the other hand, wheat has not been significantly impacted in these trade skirmishes. You know, we don't really sell much wheat to China or India or these other countries, and so the trade war has not had a noticeable impact. So my take is farmers should be satisfied, but I'm sure there'll be some, you know, questions about the actual rates per county and things like that may cause people some questions.
Yeah, and of course it always bears repeating that the farmers don't want the aid package, they want the trade to begin with.
Absolutely.
And Kevin, a lot of what we've discussed regarding the trade war, the impact on individual farmers, people just trying to get through the year, and then we've talked about this greater impact on the rest of the South Dakota economy. So talk about that a little bit, if you will. When this money starts coming in, is it just going to put your finger in the dam for your debt and keep a few farms from going bankrupt, or is it going to have a greater economic impact for the non-ag industry?
Yeah, that's a really important question, and one that unfortunately I think we're going to have to wait and see what the data shows us as we get, you know, the stimulus package unfolding. I can tell you that, you know, 6 months ago as we were touring the Midwest and talking to a lot of ag bankers, there was a lot of concern about the debt load, about payment capacity, and there was a lot of fear going into this planting season about how bad it was going to be. And so this aid package, along with kind of the conditions that have changed in the market as a result of some flooding and weather issues in the spring, has kind of propped things up. So I'm not going to say it's a huge win for the agricultural economy, but I think it's certainly a stopgap for the bleeding and the pain that we had, been feeling, say, 6 months ago.
What needs to happen next?
You know, from an ag economy standpoint, I mean, we need free trade. You know, that is the number one thing that U.S. farmers rely on. You know, we can't live in a world where we produce only for ourselves. You know, the U.S. agriculture has thrived and been able to grow because of access to the international market. We are the most efficient producers in the world, and we rely on free trade. We rely on access to those markets, and without it, it's going to be a struggle. So, you know, in the short run, this is a great Band-Aid, but in the long run, we still need some resolution to free trade.
Now, Kevin McNew isn't the only one with that particular view. In the second part of our conversation with Congressman Dusty Johnson, he shared this sentiment on international trade, and he also gave us some insight on what's being done about all those pesky robocalls.
The release of these dollars is good news for South Dakota. It's good news for American agriculture. It is not as good as a trade deal. What we need is a trade deal. And I have yet to talk to a single producer who doesn't echo that. I mean, you hear trade, not aid. You hear we can compete and win globally if we have access to markets. Access to markets. Access to markets. And as long as we continue to make progress toward opening China up, then I think there's some patience and understanding that to secure a great deal, you have to have some leverage. And that leverage, it puts American producers, particularly soybean producers, right in the crosshairs. It's very uncomfortable. So that's what this program wants to do. What this program intends to do is not make American soybean farmers bear this wildly disproportionate brunt of the pain. And it's not going to make anybody whole, but it's the right thing to do.
Are we making progress toward opening those Chinese markets?
We made a lot of progress. If there were 110 things that we wanted to get done in the China negotiation, we had gotten to somewhere between 82 and 85. Really a lot of progress in May. And people were talking about, you know, we were knocking out about 12 or 15 a week. So people started to say in late May, early June, we could be done. And then the Chinese showed up in 1 week. That week, the negotiations were in Washington, and they reneged on half. We went from 85 to 40 areas of agreement. And people had long predicted that at some point that would happen. That's not an unusual negotiating tactic for the Chinese to use. It is not what you would see from Europeans or Japanese or, you know, Americans. I mean, different countries negotiate in different ways. It was really disheartening, though. And we have yet to regain the momentum that we had in the spring.
To be fair, the Chinese are saying the Trump administration, they don't know what they want. They've been a notoriously difficult administration to negotiate with.
Yeah, I think there is not a lot of evidence for that You know, that is, of course, what the Chinese would tell their own people. I mean, they are feeling far more pain than we are. And it is a difficult political situation for the Chinese. But when you I had somebody from an emissary of Japan in my office last week, when I talked to them, or when I talked to people from EU, or when I've had, Canadians or Mexicans, representatives of governments in my office, they all talk about Bob Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative, and his team being remarkable to work with. They drive a heck of a hard bargain. But they have, Bob Lighthizer has an exhaustive knowledge of all of these issues, and he negotiates in good faith.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the Tribal School Federal Insurance Parity Act.
You know, there are so many things that just don't make sense in Washington. Part of it is that we have a federal government that is so large and so sprawling, it's hard to make it align with itself. But there are three different types of Bureau of Indian Education, BIE schools. And I won't bore your listeners with describing all three of them. But two of the three types of BIE schools qualify for federal employee health insurance and life insurance benefits. One type of the BIE school doesn't. Its employees don't qualify. And it's kind of nonsensical. You can have BIE schools 10 miles away from one another. They are serving the same types of kids. The educators are doing the same types of jobs. And in one, there is access to those benefits, and in the other, there is not. And so my bill would just make it clear that if you're working at a BIE school, you're eligible for those benefits. And I was, you kind of go to DC as a freshman in the minority and you assume you're not going to be able to get anything real done. Not the first term. That this will be I thought this would be a 2-year period where I'm building relationships both in state and in DC, and I am preparing for the opportunity to be relevant. That there's going to be a lot of homework and a lot of training before we get to race day. Lori, I have been so pleasantly surprised with the relevance I feel like I had very quickly. I mean, this bill got a hearing. For a freshman in the minority to have a hearing on a bill, they don't give hearings to bills that they want to kill. 10,000 bills are introduced in the U.S. House every year. They're not under any obligation to give any of them a hearing. And so they give hearings to bills that they think may be worth moving forward to the floor. And this would be big news for Indian country. This would be big news for Indian kids. And it's not going to lead the 6 o'clock news. It's not going to grab the front page of the New York Times, but it's going to have a real impact long-term on the outcomes that these kids are going to have.
And when are you going to stop those robocalls?
Well,
surely you have people who are calling your office saying, make the robocalls stop, and you're working on it.
Thank goodness for robocalls. They're the one thing that can bring Americans of all political stripes together.
Let's end on a truly bipartisan note.
Exactly. I would say it's going to be very tough to stop robocalls. Before I went to Congress, I spent years in the telecommunications industry in an engineering and consulting firm based out of Mitchell. And the bad guys are really good at getting around any of the filters we have, but this legislation would help.
All right. What are you looking forward to in going back this fall?
Getting the USMCA done. This deal with Canada and Mexico is a no-brainer. It's going to be really good for South Dakota manufacturers and ag producers. And then I want to try to, I know we're not going to solve the deficit overnight, but I think we have an opportunity in the fall to try to find some bipartisan ground in restoring a little bit of fiscal sanity. And that would mean a lot to my heart, to my soul, that, first let's start by not making it worse.
When farmers ask you, when? USMCA, when? Deal with China, when? What can you even tell them?
Speaker Pelosi holds a lot of cards with regard to when USMCA gets to the floor. I've been talking to a lot of my freshman Democratic colleagues, and I think they're starting to apply pressure, and I expect that we will see it in late September, early October on the floor. And if it gets to the floor, it's going to have plenty of votes to pass. This is the right thing to do. It's going to add $68 billion to America's real GDP growth, and it's going to create 176,000 jobs, and that's not me saying it. It's independent third parties.
What does Speaker Pelosi gain by not bringing it to the floor?
Well, the president, I know this will come as a surprise to your listeners, but the speaker and the president don't really like one another. And I'm sure it's true on the church board and the school board and nonprofit boards, but it's hard for people who don't like one another to work together. But this deal's too good. I think we're going to be able to rise above that kind of frayed personal relationship.
Blue Dasher Farms opens the doors for a field day featuring regenerative agriculture practices on August 10th. It's an approach to future farming with an eye toward the past. Jonathan Lundgren is CEO of Blue Dasher Farms. Here's what he had to say. Before we talk regenerative ag and what exactly that is, tell us a little bit about your operation. What is Blue Dasher Farm?
Well, we are a research and research facility that kind of focuses on regenerative ag, but we're also a demonstration farm. And so we're walking the talk. We're not just science, doing science for science's sake. We're also trying to make these things work in our own lives. And so that really distinguishes us from a lot of other places.
Help us understand the term regenerative ag, because it hasn't been around. I mean, we hear a lot of talk about sustainable agriculture. Why regenerative? What does that mean?
Well, sustainable agriculture worked for a long time, but there was a recent realization that we've just degraded our natural resource base so much that just sustaining that isn't going to be good enough for the next generation of farming. We actually need to be rebuilding our natural resource base while taking food off of the land. And that's where regenerative farming comes from. It kind of relies a lot on sustainable ag and some of the premises that were introduced there, but it elevates it to the next level.
And one of the questions is always going to be, you know, is it possible in an ag economy that is based on one system? How optimistic are you about the potential of regenerative ag?
Oh, I've seen it work. You know, if I hadn't seen it work, I would have. I started into this field pretty skeptical myself. I grew up in a fairly conventional, you know, science, applied science, agricultural science kind of background where you make the broken system work. And then I was introduced to farmers that were doing things that I said couldn't be done. And that was pretty pride swallowing. And I needed to learn a lot more. And so when I hear that question, can it work? It already does.
Tell us a little bit about what works. What are some of the hallmarks of regenerative ag?
Well, regenerative agriculture is not unified by practices. It's not like, okay, if you plant this cover crop at this time, then you're a regenerative farmer. What unites regenerative farming operations are principles. Number one is that they stop disturbing the soil. They stop tillage oftentimes. Number two is that they never leave bare soil. There's always living roots on the ground. Number three is that they're relying on plant diversity, and they incorporate as much plant diversity into their system as they can. And then number four is that they integrate livestock and plants in the same place at the same time. And when they follow these principles, and the actual systems themselves are tweaked, you know, depending on the circumstances of the farm, but when those principles are the drivers, when the farmers understand those, it's remarkable the diversity of different systems and very successful systems that these guys and gals are able to produce.
Tell us more about integrating livestock and cropping systems. What does that look like?
Well, number one, livestock includes animals more than just cows. So sheep, goats, chickens, bees, all are pork. These are all tools that farmers used to rely on as really important components of a farming operation. And then they were replaced a lot of times with technology. So on Blue Dasher, we graze our weeds. Why would I spend money on herbicides to control weeds when I could make money by grazing them with our sheep per flock? And so those sheep become a revenue stream, but also a tool that we can use for managing vegetation communities.
So tell us about this upcoming field day, and who normally comes to this sort of an event?
Well, we have hundreds that come from all over the world. That's one of the most staggering things. They come to Little Dual County, South Dakota, to see something that they've never seen before. So we're really interested in challenging new ideas. This year, we're focusing on rebuilding rural communities. This is something that I think most farmers either are or should be very concerned about. Where's the next generation going? And with regenerative farming, what we're showing is that there becomes economic opportunities for the next generations to, and excitement in that generation to farm again. And so we have speakers from Georgia as well as Nebraska. Will Harris, who, if you haven't seen 100,000 Beating Hearts, you need to get online like right now and watch that movie. It's free. It's on Vimeo, but it's about what he's done in his community. That's, mind-boggling. And then Steve Tucker, who's down in Nebraska, and he's been doing some amazing things with regional cooperatives with other regenerative farmers that's really opening up new opportunities for his operation.
What kind of questions do people ask you when they can, you know, converge for something like that? What are some of the top? It has to be inspiring to a certain extent where people are getting ideas and that synergy is happening. But what are some of the frustrations that you hear?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that the biggest is a fear of change, and that's totally understandable. I mean, what we're talking about is a systems level change, and so that transition period, as farmers are starting to learn what regenerative operations look like, can be kind of a frightening time. But right now, there's so much support that we, and Blue Dasher is just one venue of that support or one option for that support. Farmers that are interested in going this route, a community is developing right now, even in eastern South Dakota or in South Dakota at large.
What sort of research? You said you're a research facility. What kind of research needs to happen to sort of push the conversation forward and come up with the next, the next big advancement or innovation in regenerative agriculture?
Well, I think that there hasn't been a lot of research in regenerative agriculture yet. It's the farmers have been leading this movement way, way ahead of the science. And so at Blue Dasher, we're trying to bring the science and just understand what these guys are doing first. So we're validating those systems. We found that the regenerative farmers in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Nebraska were twice as profitable as their conventional corn farming neighbors. I mean, twice as profitable, while restoring their natural resource base. So those types of studies that validate this approach to food production in a lot of really important and relevant systems is critical. So we're working in rangelands right now. We're working in almonds. We're working in small grain production systems up in Canada to try to do that validation. And then the next research that really needs to happen is that, okay, those are established systems. Those are best management practices on both sides of the aisle, right? This is the best management practice for conventional production, and we're comparing that apples to apples to the best management practices in regenerative management. Then we need to start to understand what that transition looks like, to remove barriers and hurdles from farmers that want to start thinking about adopting these approaches so that we can make that transition as easy and seamless as possible.
And for people who say, you know, this is an export-based industry, we have to feed the world. We can't sacrifice yield. We can't sacrifice quantity or exports. What's your thoughts on, how do you respond to that?
Well, we're not sacrificing food production as a result of a regenerative system. I think that actually we're going to be producing as much, if not more, calories per acre as we are currently. And we need to be, and currently we produce way more food than we need. It's more of a distribution problem than it is an actual production problem. We need to grow food. We need to grow food for our communities. And we need to and grow it in a way that the next generation can reap the benefits as well.
Support for Technology and Innovation Reporting comes from SDN Communications, your business broadband provider. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
Now, not everything in the ag industry is gloomy. The South Dakota Department of Ag says that even during these downtimes, agriculture continues to thrive. And while the number of farms in the state declined by 6% since 2012, livestock inventory is on the rise. Rick Valerie joined In the Moment to talk about the study. He's senior advisor for South Dakota's Department of Ag. Here's Rick.
Well, I think the first key takeaway is that the $6.9 billion increase in economic activity compared to the 2014 study is a huge, huge number to kind of focus on. And again, I want to reiterate that it is a snapshot, but one of the things that we did by generating that number, it points out that agriculture is strong and agricultural industries are strong in South Dakota. And there's lots of different examples of that. But again, they're just snapshot examples, and we have to kind of look at this as a very broad brush type stroke, continue to see how the trends develop, which is what we're doing with this study.
All right. So we're looking at that $32.5 billion economic contribution. How are we defining farm here? Because it's not just, an acre of land or so. There's other things that are sort of factored into this. Explain that for us, please.
The company that does this for us and the company that did it for us 5 years ago, which is Decision Innovation Solution, uses the federal definition, which is $1,000 or more income. So we have a very broad base of different variety of incomes and different acreages and different livestock versus crop versus sheep versus cattle, whatever. And it's all based in a broad-based picture or snapshot for trend development. And so it's important for the folks to understand that this contribution study is as best as we can make it apples to apples. So when we use the 2012, when we did it 5 years ago in the 2014 study, we're using the same type of company, we're using the same data and data sets, and we're using the same definitions, and we're using the same economic model that is being used by Decision Innovation Solutions.
So what do we know about where that $6.9 billion increase is coming from? What grew?
Well, it actually covers a number of groups. What we can tell in a, again, broad stroke, that livestock did very well the last 5 years. And it's in the livestock industry. While the numbers in the beef side of it stayed relatively stable, we definitely saw increases in the hog and the dairy industries. Plus, we absolutely saw agribusiness in the livestock industry expand. And then the other example on the beef side would be the packing plant addition in Aberdeen.
When we talk about the numbers of livestock going up, are we measuring who owns that livestock? If there's corporate ownership, even though a farmer might own the land, the livestock might be owned by an out-of-state corporation. Are those broken down in the report to sort of measure the impact of that?
The answer to that is yes, and it really points out to the good, strong, hardworking farmers and ranchers we have in South Dakota. In essence, about 83%, a little bit over that, is sole proprietorship. We have approximately 8% or a little higher in partnerships, and we have 6% that are in family farm-held corporations. So we have a very, 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 very small percentage of non-farm corporate ownership in the state of South Dakota, and that just goes back why they use the different structures might be for tax reasons or for inheritance reasons or whatever, but it's strong South Dakota farm and rancher values that are all connected to the family.
So I'm going to read from the report there to sort of reiterate what you just said, because it says out of the 29,968 farms in South Dakota, 83% of farms are owned by families or individuals, 8% are in partnerships, and 6% are in family-held corporations. Only 1% are in corporations that are not family-held. So just reiterating what you just said from the report, and one of my questions is, do you break down in the report then of that 1%, how much acres, I see an average for the average size of a farm. How many acres are held by that 1%? How big is that 1%?
We do not know on the 1%, but we can tell you that the number of farm operations by size varies greatly, and it varies by different operation style. So what we can point out is that approximately 6,000, maybe a little bit more, of the farms are actually less than 50 acres in the state of South Dakota. And then the rest are higher than that, which would be about 12,000 acres. or 12,000 operations. And so they're broke down by different acreages. And if you kind of want to go, you see major increases in farm operations, which is going to add to about the 12,000 in acreages that are 250 acres and higher.
Repeat that information for me, please. I got a little lost there.
250 acres and higher represents approximately 12,000 farm operations.
Thank you for that. 48,913 total producers in the state, 63% of the principal producers age 55 and older, only 1% under the age of 25. What does that tell you about the future of farming and some of the challenges ahead?
Well, we know there's going to be a change coming from a department standpoint to encourage a lot of inheritance planning, estate planning. We also know that there's a pretty good number of young people waiting in the wings. And they're going to bring some different thought processes to a lot of the different operations and how maybe they might be more interested in no-till versus conventional till or whatever it is. But that is going to be a trend that will be changing, and we will be getting younger. It might be 10 years from now. But the key to it is that technology will probably drive some of that, and that's probably good for agriculture.
When we talk technology, let's talk jobs. What do we know about the labor impact and the workforce impact of the ag industry in South Dakota from this report?
Well, from this report, we basically increased jobs by about 22% to a total of approximately 132,105 jobs. And again, that is a very broad stroke. It might be jobs in actual agriculture production, or it might be jobs in ag-related industries.
Tell me what added value is in this report.
Well, again, it's very broad.
Yeah.
And so they basically kind of use everything. It might be here, let me give this example to you. In the added value or the added sales that we kind of see, some of those things come from quote-unquote other agriculture. Well, what is other agriculture? Well, that might be farm-to-market, that might be organic, that might be natural, that might be the bee industry and the honey industry. And so it's very broad, but all contribute toward the definition of $1,000 or more. That's under the agricultural definition. So it's kind of everything.
And we're seeing, what, an $11.2 billion impact in added value from those areas?
Correct.
Interesting. Any surprises in this for you as you look through the numbers?
Actually, the only surprise I really had was the number of farms under 50 acres. And I really think that's positive. And I know one of the things we've had discussions at the department is to see how we may address some of their issues a little differently than in the past. But that was a surprise. I really did not think there were that many farms less than 50 acres.
And how many was that? Like 5,000 something? I see 4,546 of 10 to 50.
Yeah,
then
you add the other one, which is 6,000. About 6,000. About a third of the total farming operations in the state.
Interesting. So they would have entirely different needs and issues than a large farm.
Correct. Now, the other thing that we have to keep in mind, that can be a one-horse farm, and it's just a family pet. But if you have a sale of a horse and it was over $1,000, then you qualify. So we have to be careful with that.
Right.
But I still think that was an interesting number. It was a little bit higher than I thought it would be. And we'll see how it works out for the next time.
Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter Seth Tupper and Madison Daily Leader publisher John Hunter step in to talk about this week's political news. All right, let's start a little bit with U.S. Senator Mike Rounds and following the money, because it's not as easy as you think, maybe, Seth Tupper, to figure out where all that money is coming from for a campaign. Walk us through sort of why you wanted to sort of look at this, for starters.
Well, to me, I just thought it was really reflective of the advantages of incumbency and, you know, how difficult it is for somebody to try to challenge an incumbent. Because, you know, Skylar Borglum from Rapid City here, state legislator, who said she's going to challenge Senator Rounds in the primary election next year, she formed her fundraising committee in June, starting from zero. And at that point, Mike Rounds already had $1.4 million in his own campaign committee account. But he doesn't just have a campaign committee that's helping him directly or indirectly with fundraising and spending. He has these other entities, including he has what's known as a leadership PAC, a political action committee, which he calls the Peter Norbeck Leadership PAC, named for Peter Norbeck, a legendary former governor and senator in South Dakota. And that had $67,000 on hand at the end of 2018 at the time of its last report. He's also a part of what's known as a joint fundraising committee with 15 other incumbent U.S. senators who are up for re-election next year. And a joint committee, which is something that was used by Kristi Noem to great effect during her Donald Trump fundraiser in 2018, that allows innumerable different committees to join together and pool campaign contribution limits into one bigger limit. So whereas I might only be able to write a $2,700 check to you because of campaign contribution limits, when I go to a joint fundraising committee, they can compile all those $2,700 limits together and I can write you a check for, you know, $27,000, and then they split it up evenly among everybody who's in the joint fundraising committee. So he's part of one of those, and that's already given him $53,000 roughly after it was just organized not too long ago. And then he also has he's part of another joint fundraising committee called Rounds SDGOP Victory Fund, which hasn't been very active yet, but is there and could get active. And then he's got the American Chemistry Council is spending independently promote the Rounds campaign, and that group said it was spending $69,000 recently on a 2-week run of radio and television ads. And those are independent expenditures, which are unlimited as long as there isn't any coordination with the candidates that are mentioned. And so you've got all that, as you mentioned, I call it a multifaceted fundraising apparatus, which is really what it is. And you got all that stacking up against, again, Skylar Borglum, who started with zero.
So before we get to that, I want to, the American Chemistry Council can spend $69,000 without coordinating with the candidate. So that means U.S. Senator Rounds can't talk to them. Like, what are the limitations to that? Because clearly he knows.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you'd have to delve into the case law and the FEC rules and everything. But, you know, essentially it just means that to have that privilege to be able to spend unlimited amounts as an independent spender, you have to not coordinate that spending with the Rounds committee. So they can't meet and say, hey, let's make our ads look like this and let's run them at this time and let's do this. There needs to be no coordination at all on those things.
Interesting.
And, of course, there's all kinds of suspicions of whether there is ever any coordination, but, you know, that's...
And why the Chemistry Council? And John Hunter just knows I'm going to pull him in at this moment.
Well, I like Seth's idea of writing $2,700 checks to you, Lori, for your next campaign.
Let's. I've decided not to run because I'd like to spend more time with my family. So
we'll set up a pact for your potential future campaign.
That's the Seth Tupper line that I just use every time anyone says that. John Hunter, this is a really stark picture. Whether you agree with, you know, how campaign finance works in this country, you better understand how it works if you're going to run for office against someone like U.S. Senator Mike Rounds, against any incumbent.
Agreed. And I think the best we can come, you know, they're creative people, and the laws are written typically by incumbent members of Congress, and so yeah, there is going to be money there. I mean, that's just the reality, and whether you like it or not, as in your words, you have to be aware of it. And that's why I think really we should push for the kind of transparency as best we can, and keep working on that all the time. And Seth has done a nice job in digging into this stuff, because most South Dakotans wouldn't know that without that kind of journalism. But candidates need to know about it. I think donors need to know about those. Voters need to know about those. They really, although I will caveat that a little bit, I'd rather the voters focused on issues and how their members will vote on things rather than who's raising the most money. I mean, right. It's interesting and it's relevant, but I'd rather focus on what they are, what's in their platforms.
Right. But John, this brings up the point that when we look at like the joint committees, these people are donating money for a number of campaigns. It's not, maybe, is it an illusion to think that people are just giving to the candidate that they support because of their platform? People are giving to an idea. They're giving to a party. They're giving to an ideology.
Well, wouldn't you expect that that's probably increasing, that yeah. people are more ideologues than they were, and members who are loyal to the party line will benefit financially from that. So I think that's one thing, and that's part of the partisanship that we see, is that I think more members of Congress are turning over their votes to the party leadership and saying, you know, how am I going to vote? I remember asking the last time Tim Johnson stopped in to the Daily Leader just as he was completing his final term in the Senate, I asked just that question. I said, are more people turning over their votes to the party? And his answer was yes. So to me, that would be most of the fun of being in Congress, would be voting your own conscience and so forth. But again, you can see if you do vote as the group votes, then there could be campaign resources available to you.
All right. So along comes Skylar Borglum. And Seth, you did a profile of her, and you can find it at rapidcityjournal.com. And boy, I wish I could get the Rapid City Journal delivered to my front step every day, Seth. Because
well,
you're just
digitally, you can certainly subscribe digitally. And have it.
That I do, and for the record, and then, but I just like the paper, so that's just me. All right, so Skylar Borglum is talking about the exhausted middle, in quotation marks, of the GOP, according to the headline. Tell us a little bit about your meeting with her and trying to learn about who she is and why she would take this on in her own party.
Yeah, I kind of started, the reason I wanted to do a profile was, you know, it was actually a question Noel Hamill asked me. He hit me up one day and said he heard she had a connection to Kimball. And so he said, so you probably know a lot about her, huh? That's my hometown.
Right.
I said, really? She has a connection to Kimball? I didn't know that. So, and it just reminded me that, yeah, what do I or anyone really know about her? Not much. She came kind of out of nowhere and won election to the legislature, you know, in 2018, was appointed first. And so I thought, yeah, I mean, there needs to be a profile done of her to, you know, who is this person? So that's why I did it. And also the fact, obviously, she's from Rapid City right here in our right. backyard. But, yeah, it turns out she's a person who's incredibly highly educated. She has five college degrees. Her husband has three, so there's eight total in their household. she has a lot of other diverse experience. She worked in pharmaceutical sales. She's worked in engineering. Currently works as a staff engineer at Respec, which is a business here in Rapid City. But this thing about the exhausted middle, one of the questions I really wanted to ask her was that, you know, by running against an incumbent in her own party, she's sort of alienated the establishment within the party. And it doesn't seem that the people who consider themselves to be more conservative, more right-wing in the party, that they're very fond of her either. We've had Phil Jensen, who considers himself a very conservative legislator here in Rapid City, wrote a op-ed piece for us recently where he took Skylar Borglum to task for some of her votes in the legislature. So she seems to have, as I said, alienated or at least angered or upset the establishment and the far-right faction of the party. And so I asked her, who's left that's going to vote for you? And that was her response, was what she called the exhausted middle, people who don't consider themselves to be establishment or on the far right of the party and are tired of sort of the factionalism and want more of a common sense approach. And that's her theory and of who she's going for anyway.
So she was appointed to the state legislature kind of from nowhere, or did she have connections with the party to begin with?
Now, as far as I can tell, it was kind of from nowhere. I mean, she moved to South Dakota in 2015. Her roots, just to get back to where I started, her mother grew up in Kimball. Her father grew up in Watertown. And so she does have, you know, connections to the state. But she grew up in Montana, in Great Falls, Montana, and moved around during her adult life and came to South Dakota in 2015. And so then within 3 years of moving here, she had filed a candidacy for the legislature already, and there was a seat in her district that was vacated by the death of Sean McPherson, who was a Republican legislator here. And so at the time, Governor Dugard took the action of appointing her to that seat. At the time, I believe there was a special session coming up, and it appeared that the logic was, well, you know, she's already running, and we need all the seats filled for this special section. So he appointed her, which was fortuitous for her, and then she ran in November and won. But yeah, she didn't seem to have any, you know, it was her first run for public office. She didn't seem to have any, you know, connections prior to that. She came in and won a race, and here we are.
John Hunter, what do you think, you know, a candidate like Skylar, so I like it when people run against, because I just think it's great to talk about ideas. That's kind of the thing I nerd out on. But do you think that it's good for the party? Is it good for South Dakota to have someone like Skylar Borglum starting a conversation, running a campaign against someone like Mike Rounds?
I do. I think it's healthy for democracy and for South Dakota. I actually appreciate the fact that she is not pigeonholing herself into a party line or into a particular faction line, that she may make decisions that either satisfied or dissatisfied all sorts of people.
Right.
Right? And I think it gets back a little bit to voting her own conscience. And in South Dakota, and Seth and I have observed this legislature for a long time, and most of that is people talking and trying to listen and trying to do what's best for their constituents in their district or for the state as a whole. And yes, there's party influence, but it's not really as extreme at all, in my opinion, as it is in Washington. So to have a South Dakotan say, yeah, I'm going to vote for this, which some people in the party like and some people don't like, and I think that's a healthy process. And it gets the focus back to issues rather than loyalty to the platform.
Right. And Seth, let's talk about a little bit of her legislative record, because some of those things that she alienated people like Phil Jensen about were things that she said the government shouldn't be involved in deciding anyway, and those are her conservative principles. Tell us a little more about that, please.
Yeah, that was fascinating to me, because among the people, again, who consider themselves a conservative wing of the Republican Party, they look at some of her votes. For example, she voted against the bill that's been getting a lot of attention lately that required the posting of In God We Trust signage in schools. She voted against that. That was one example. There were other similar bills that were all kind of social issue type bills that she voted against. And the conservative wing of the party looks at that and says, well, she's not a real conservative. And her response to that in my interview with her was to double down and say, no, I'm the real conservative and they're not. And the way she explains that, her logic is that she views conservative as people who, I had a quote in the story that says, governments should stay out of people's business unless there's an absolute demonstrated need to get into it. That's her view as she stated it. And so that's where she's at with it. And it's kind of an interesting approach. I mean, a lot of times we see politicians try to fit into one mold or another. And she's saying, no, the mold that you're trying to put me in, you have a wrong idea of what conservative is, and I have the right idea. Again, whether that's going to work or not, whether the exhausted middle that she talks about will actually support her and come out to vote, you know, remains to be seen. But that's the approach she's trying to take.
The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Instagram at @SDPBInTheMoment and Twitter @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.